even if you are at war with a city, you must not destroy its trees, for the tree of the fields is man's life. Tidings from Hazel Khan, and today we're talking about olive oil from Palestine. We're also telling the story of Zatoun, a Canadian grassroots organization founded by Robert Massoud in 2003 to support Palestinian farmers in the West Bank by promoting and selling their olive oil in North America for fair trade prices. The interview with Robert Massoud that you are about to hear was conducted over 3 years ago in 2008, and I am most unhappy to report that nothing good has happened to Palestine's olive trees since then. The Israeli occupation of Palestine is an enemy of the olive tree and the olive farmer, not only because of the degraded circumstances under which growing, picking, and pressing take place, but because of Israel's ongoing policy of uprooting the olive trees, one of the many catastrophic weapons of occupation. The degradation of oil production has had severe implications for the Palestinian economy. Attacks on agricultural land and the harassment of farmers have reduced the quality and the quantity of oil production. Not being able to care for or tend the trees in the months prior to the harvest affects yield quantity and quality. After picking, the damaging presence of the occupation affects how olives are stored and transported, how long they are kept before pressing, the quality of the oil pressing process, and how long the oil is stored after pressing. Farmers are working under severe limitations during each of these steps in the process. Ben Lorber, reporting in the Palestine Chronicle on November 7th this year, writes that the 2011 olive harvest, which began in early October, has seen a troubling rise in settler attacks. On October 20th, Oxfam reported that Israeli settlers have already cost West Bank Palestinian farmers $500,000 this year in destroyed olive trees. In September alone, 2,500 olive trees were destroyed, out of 7,500 destroyed so far this year, and a conservative estimate of 800,000 destroyed since Israel's annexation of the West Bank in 1967. This is particularly damaging because this year's olive harvest is expected to yield only half of the oil of last year's harvest, making each tree all the more valuable to the farmers. If the past is any indication of the future, it's difficult to be optimistic. Israeli settlers have become a greater source of destruction and intimidation in recent years, attacking farmers during the harvest and destroying the trees throughout the year. When building of the separation wall is completed, a further 1 million trees will be trapped between the wall and the green line, making them inaccessible to farmers. And we point out that the economic loss to farmers is not a unique one-time event, but an ongoing erosion that is repeated year after year. There are untold costs to the occupation, Robert Massoud tells me in an email, and they will never come close to being fully known. Too many interests are vested in hidden reality and hidden history. That we have any Zatoun olive oil in North America, and that it is as good as it is a miracle. Can't make olive oil without olives, and you can't get olives without olive trees, and you can't have olive trees without land, and you can't get abundant harvests of olives from these trees without the farmers who know and understand them and who have tended them over generations. When we buy olive oil from Spain or Italy or Greece, we don't think much about the journey from the olive tree to the bottle on our kitchen counter. And when we think about olives, we probably don't think about Palestine, and many of us don't even know that we can buy Palestinian olive oil in North America. And even if we know all that, we may not realize the many, many obstacles that stand between those Palestinian olive trees and the olive oil that is brought to us by an organization like Zatoun, an Arabic word that means olive. Robert Massoud is my guest today, and he brings tidings about Zatoun, the grassroots organization he started in Toronto to promote and sell olive oil produced by Palestinian farmers. Robert is a Christian Palestinian whose family came from Ramleh. They came to Canada in 1964 when Robert was a young boy. So, Robert, you were born in a convent. How did that happen?
Well, my father was a plant superintendent of Saint-Vincent-de-Paul, which is, even today, the largest convent in the Holy Land. And so he was responsible for maintenance and all types of new construction. And we lived there in a small apartment that gave to the exterior. And that's where my parents had come to in Jerusalem from their native Ramleh, which is a town about half an hour from Jerusalem. That Ramleh was where they were born and were during the Nakba in 1948 as young teenagers at that point. And in the 50s, they emigrated to Jerusalem, and that's where he found work. And I was born in the convent at that point.
Just tell our listeners what Nakba means.
Well, Nakba is the Arabic word for catastrophe. So 1948 has this duality where for the Jewish population, it's called Independence Day. And for Palestinians, both inside Israel and outside Israel in the diaspora, it's called the Nakba, being the catastrophe. Because essentially in 1948 and earlier in 1947 during the partition plan, the Palestinians were really at the short end of that entire process, having essentially lost their entire patrimony through those two stages. If you look back to the early part of the 20th century, Palestinians owned and occupied 98% of present-day Palestine, and now it's virtually only 13% in the West Bank and Gaza, and even then it's problematic. So that entire 100-year process has led to the almost virtual complete dispossession of the land and the freedoms and the rights of Palestinians on that land, and that's why they call it the catastrophe.
Well, let's just go back in time from today a little bit. Your family came to Canada when you were 6 years old. And I think you mentioned the word duality or something like that before, but you grew up with a duality around two narratives. You were a Palestinian, but that was not an identity you could be very proud of or clear about. And you were also Canadian. You spoke several languages, French, Hebrew, Arabic, and English. So there were a lot of contradictions. How did you deal with these contradictions?
In Canada, I'm Palestinian, and I have a hard time saying that or people accepting that or dealing with it. So for a good part of my early years, I would just say I'm Lebanese because that's what people could relate to. They could not really relate to a Palestine just because either they didn't know about it. They were, really just not knowing, or whatever they knew tended to be or could be negative.
How did the duality, though, your relationship to being a Palestinian, how did that actually lead to Zatoun? Tell us the story.
From the youngest age, I somehow knew that I would need to become involved in the larger question of Palestine and where Palestine sits in people's consciousness. I just was not ready to embark on that until, you could say, just in the last 5 years. So there's this sense of needing to, be a spokesperson, not necessarily a spokesperson, but to be able to stand up in full confidence and in full sort of acceptance and say, I'm Palestinian and I've got nothing to be ashamed of. I've got nothing to be excusing myself for. This is who I am. This is my background. This is who we are, what we've been through. And we can stand up and talk about it like anyone else can.
But Robert, for you, I mean, how did you actually start dealing with olives? You know, how did it become olives and zaytun and everything?
I was looking for what is my voice. To go back a little bit, for Palestinians, voice is very important because traditionally in the last 60 years and so, particularly in the West, we have felt voiceless. It's like there is very little opportunity, very little opening for a Palestinian voice. You know, it's like being in the forest amid hurricanes and winds, and you know, you're screaming, but nobody can hear you. There's a real element of voicelessness. So that's what I focused on, was how to give voice to being Palestinian. And I just felt very sort of organically, intuitively, that it couldn't be in the traditional modes of politics or media, because, you know, they just haven't been there for Palestinian narrative. They've just basically shut it out.
You're listening to Tidings from Hazel Khan. I'm speaking with Robert Massoud, the founder of Zaytun, about the struggle of Palestinian olive farmers to produce olive oil for export.
I hit upon 5 years ago the use of olive oil to sell fair trade, extra virgin olive oil made in Palestine and bring it to North America, and in that way get North Americans to experience the oil, not to hear about it and not to kind of see it as a kind of, a media item or a political item, but something that spoke to them, to their humanity, to their individuality, and also spoke to them out of this, I think, this massively symbolic item, product, that has not just something as a food, but has huge spiritual and symbolic significance to many religions and also secularism, where people can...
Yeah, talk about that a little bit more, what the significance has been, you know, reaching back in time.
Well, I mean, going back to Noah's Ark and in so many different modes, including, you know, Greek mythologies, the olive tree having the symbolism of eternity, of peace, of wisdom, divinity, warmth, wealth, lighting, dark spaces and dark corners being the oil that's used to light the lamps. I mean, when you think of, for instance, ancient Israel, the kings of ancient Israel only became kings after being anointed with the oil. When you think of Hanukkah, I mean, Hanukkah is really the lighting of the oil lamps. So for every religion, whether it's Christianity, Judaism, or Islam, and even secularism, I mean, there is a narrative, there is a story behind behind olives and olive oil. And that's what people, I think, are responding to, whether consciously or unconsciously.
Yeah, I think you said somewhere it's a real substance that can't be spun or manipulated.
Yes, exactly so. Because, I mean, the oil is what it is. You cannot deny it. And so when someone attacks the oil, I think they end up looking pretty foolish because it's only olive oil. And it's only olive oil that is produced by ordinary people, by farmers in dire straits, under very difficult conditions. And, you know, why and how can we be threatened by that?
What when you said, what kind of things do people say against it? You said they look pretty foolish, but what is it?
Well, I mean, I've been accused at various times of being a terrorist organization. You know, Zaytoun's a terrorist organization. How is it that Zaytoun brings peace? You know, what is all this gobbledygook about peace? How do you contribute to peace?
Well, talk about that a little bit more, because Palestinian olive oil, I mean, we're talking about olive oil generically, the symbolism and the history and so on, but there's something special about Palestinian olive oil simply because of all the obstacles that it has to overcome to get to us over here. And it's not like from Italy or Spain or Greece. It has a very different route that it has to take. So maybe just talk about some of the actual obstacles that the Palestinian farmers have to encounter and, you know, for the oil to come to our table here.
It's special because I think the conditions under which it has come to be and to be grown. I mean, you, in a sense, unless someone is there to see how things are done, you really can't appreciate what a miracle it is to have this olive oil in North America on our tables. The farmers, and we're talking about small farmers. This is not agribusiness by any stretch of the imagination. These are farmers who own anywhere from, 50 trees to 300 or 400 trees. And they basically are trying to gain access, and they don't do it successfully very often because a lot of these trees, a lot of the land is, for whatever reason, closed under military orders. Is too close to a settlement, or in some cases even far from a settlement, but the farmers are not allowed to actually go to their land and tend these trees. So many, many trees have been abandoned, you could say. Whole tracts of acres and acres and hundreds of acres of trees have been abandoned because the farmers who own them can't travel there to tend to the trees. See, this is the difficulty about speaking about Israel and Palestine, in a sense that there is no single answer to everything. The occupation operates at so many levels, using so many different tools, that, to say because of the wall is correct, but it certainly is not sufficient. It does not come close to portraying 20 or 30 different ways of keeping farmers away from their land. For instance, the need for permits, that you can't go onto your land without a permit, but you can't get a permit. That the permit is only given to the person, the title holder of the land, who happens to be the 90-year-old grandfather and nobody else. Or that the land is behind a fence with a gate, and that gate is supposed to be opened, but it's only open for 15 minutes in the morning and 15 minutes in the evening, and sometimes it's not opened at all. So there is confiscation of equipment, of farming equipment. When I talk farming equipment, I don't mean tractors and things. I mean things like donkeys, I think very, rudimentary, very basic equipment. So these are some of the restrictions. And of course, we haven't even gone into the wall, and the wall is perhaps the greatest single threat in the last 5 years, because as you know, the wall is being built almost entirely inside of Palestine, both on the eastern side and the western side. And what's going to happen is about 2 million trees will be trapped between the existing green line and the wall. And these trees will not be able to be tended in any way because they're on the wrong side of the wall from their occupant.
there's two other problems. One is the actual uprooting of olive trees. I think something like 1 million trees have been uprooted over the last however many years.
Yes, exactly. So, for instance, you could say since 1967 to the wall, at least 1 million trees have been uprooted to make room for settlements, to make room for roads, to make room for security buffers, and whatever other reason the Israeli government has come up with as an excuse for destroying these trees. So you have 1 million trees being destroyed over the last 30 years, and then you have at least another 300,000, 400,000 trees being destroyed to make room for the wall, to the course of the wall to run around most of Palestine. And then you have the trees that are being frozen out because of the construction of the wall. So in total, you've got maybe 3 to 4 million trees being taken out of production. The reality is that those trees belong to certain families, existed in a certain place where their family, their generations have been, their culture, their history, their you know, extended family. So when those trees are gone, the means for that family and the extent and their extended family have been destroyed. Their connection to their ties to that particular part of the land have been destroyed. And so there's a real human loss here. There's a human impact that goes beyond just economics. It's not about economics. And when you're in Palestine, if you have been there and you you know, are in the countryside and have visited farmers and so on, and even among city dwellers, you realize this is not just a tree. This is a holy tree. The way the Palestinians talk about their olive trees, the way they treat their olive trees, the way they, you know, in their cultures, their songs, their music centered around the trees. You know, this is not any tree. In Palestine, the olive tree is holy. And people are tied to those trees at many levels. They're tied to these trees because they represent their attachment to the land. Because the tree is everywhere in the land. And the tree is what rooted them to a particular place, a particular village, a particular town, and has, you know, provided sustenance for generations.
And in the Old Testament, in I think it's on your website, this verses in Deuteronomy, which says, even if you are at war with a city, you must not destroy its trees, for the tree of the fields is man's life. Which so the Bible's already been telling us that for a long time.
The trees really represent the earth. What the Bible says is, even in wartime, you can't shock and awe and scorch the earth for military gains, because people depend on the earth.
Palestinian olive oil is also special because of the unique difficulties that Palestinian farmers face in getting their product, basically getting it to market, getting it, you know, from the olives on the trees to the end product, the bottle of olive oil. Could you talk about that process a little bit?
Yes. Well, I think the reality is that there is no agribusiness. These farmers are small farmers. They're independent, and also the other situation that affects it is that there is no industrial infrastructure to speak of. In many ways, Palestine exists in a time warp of the 19th century. As much of the world has raced ahead to globalization, the occupation has actually reversed Palestine's development. And we can see this in the whole process, bringing the olive oil to North America. At harvest time, whole families will visit the olive groves to pick the ripe fruit. They bag the olives and transport them to a central olive press, usually one press for many communities or many locations. And they'll use any means available, a donkey, cart, tractor, or car, over fields and usually broken roads that have been mauled over by tank tracks. Once the oil is pressed, the farmers carry the oil back to their homes in cans, waiting for the orders to come. There is no central storage, which would be a huge improvement for everyone involved, but there just is no central storage capacity whatsoever. So once an order is received, the oil is collected from a number of farmers to make up the quantity needed. From there, it's tested and then brought to a bottling facility, a central bottling facility. And again, we're talking about a very small facility, probably like 400, 500, 600 square feet. We're not talking, you know, massive factory-type situations. And there is no glass production in Palestine of any kind other than artisanal. So the bottles that are used have to actually be imported from Italy. One of the things I wanted to mention was that our goal has always been to have maximum value added in Palestine. So we get the printing of the labels done there, the cartons are done there, the labor is done there, so that there is maximum, as I said, value added to Palestinians, not just farmers. Once the bottles have been completed and cartoned, they then have to, of course, be shipped to the port of Haifa, where they leave onto an overseas container. But to get there, they have to travel an hour through the green line and a checkpoint. Now, you know, we need to understand what a checkpoint is. A checkpoint is not as we might think it is in the sense of crossing a border, you show your papers, and then you just keep going in the vehicle that you're in. The way it works with many, many of the checkpoints in Palestine is that you have to literally coordinate another vehicle to meet you on the other side. So in this case of the olive oil, the truck backs up to the checkpoint and is met on the other side by another truck that's backed up, and they literally have to unload their entire 20 skids or 40 skids, however many they have. So in our case, 20,000 bottles or almost 20,000 or 20 tons of oil have to be unloaded and reloaded onto another vehicle. This takes literally a whole day and is very expensive. So you can imagine the additional costs that we have to cover.
We're going to have to end our conversation, but people, I'm sure, are dying to know where they can get Palestinian olive oil. The best way to get it is to go to the Zaatoun website, and Zaatoun is Zaatoun. So that's zaatoun.com. And if you go there, you will find not only olive oil, but also olive soap and some other products and other activities that Zaatoun is involved in. And that's the best way, really, for you to be able to get a bottle of olive oil from Palestine and support the Palestinian farmers. Zaatoun.com, Zaatoun.com.
This is Tidings from Hazel Khan. You've been listening to my interview with Robert Massoud, founder of Zaatoun, the Toronto-based grassroots organization that supports Palestinian farmers by promoting and selling their olive oil in North America at fair trade prices. You can listen to Tidings on the second Wednesday of every month at 7:30 p.m. on WPKN 89.5 Bridgeport, and streaming live and archived at wpkn.org, and anytime on my website, tidingsfromhazel.org.